Hello, everyone. Welcome to Masterclass. Tonight, February 9th, 2023. We have four presenters this evening. Should be a nice busy one. But they have some great things that they're going to talk about. Michael LaFranchi is going to talk about security risks for autonomous vehicles and AI. David Haslam is going to talk about investigative techniques for forensic cybersecurity. Von Erich Young will talk about virtualization. And Evan Dix will talk about load balancing. So, should be interesting. Let's see. All right, Michael, are you ready?
Yeah. Yeah, I just got to share my screen, right?
That's right.
All right, let's see here.
Take it away from me.
Alrighty. All right, can everyone see my PowerPoint?
Yes.
All right, well, I chose to do my master class on a project that I'm working on outside of school. I'm actually writing a book, and I decided to write this book a while back when I started getting ideas after learning a lot about autonomous AI and how we are incorporating it into our vehicles and our traffic network. And I kind of playing along the lines of an adventure novel, I kind of started writing it and I got through a few chapters, but then I realized I really need to focus on some of the technical things. So I twisted this around into a research project. And I really decided after a while that I could turn it into a masterclass as well because it has so much in-depth information. So this is kind of an overview of what I've been researching and how it ties into the book. So let's get started. Right. Research regarding the cybersecurity fiction novel that I'm writing. We're going to talk about AI, autonomous vehicles, and cell phone tower connections. So today's interconnected, technological-driven, automated world has given birth to the idea that a fully autonomous vehicles are possible in our late lifetime. To achieve these, sensors, AI, radar, satellites, cell towers, and a whole myriad of other technologies have to work together. All these systems are connected to form a large vulnerability surface area with many access points to consider. The possibility of overtaking a vehicle systems for malicious intent should be paramount when designing these systems. And it got me thinking, what if? What if someone was to take advantage of this in the future? How do we lock it down? How do we secure it? My book, As Technologies Connect Through the World, The Risk Rises for Hackers to Design Ways to Utilize These Systems. The novel centers around a semi-retired cybersecurity and programming employee. The poor guy is forced into retirement from his organization due to a security flaw that he found in the technology AI that he made. I know the organizations are big into controlling the intellectual property that they have, and sometimes people are forced right out of the company because of mistakes. The flaw allows for a hacker or any malicious user to gain access to all vehicles and gain control of them under certain circumstances. Keep in mind, this is in the future. The basis of the story relies on a switch over to manual controls of vehicles being a security flaw and not being able to. Imagine, if you would, being in a fully autonomous vehicle and somebody taking it over and not allowing you to get out of it. Think of the movie Speed, but in the future, when you can't even get out of your own vehicle. The goal of this research project was to develop accurate and modern situations for the novel, to research the technology used for these types of environments, and to research autonomous and AI automatic vehicles. Let's get going here. Artificial intelligence. Transportation is actually already relying on AI for trains and is working to make aircraft more intelligent and automated. Machine learning and algorithms in these examples are contained into the areas in which they operate. For example, you don't see someone publicly driving a train down the road. And a lot of people don't fly the plane that they're on when they're going from A to B. So when using AI to help machine learning and algorithms in these examples, they're contained in these environments that the public can't access. The vehicles that we have on the road, on the other hand, are used freely by billions of people every day all over the place. These bullets that we're driving down the road are controlled by us. And if we were to hand those over to technology, the technology has to be secure and reliable. Research shows that one technology is being utilized for study that relies on heat signatures to determine objects in an environment. The objects in this example by the author Kolikar, they identify as drivable, non-drivable, living things, vehicles, roadside objects, and far objects. Another great example of a technology that we can use is explainable artificial intelligence, XAI. I don't know if anyone has heard of this yet. It's being developed by DARPA. It is the direction AI will need to go in for safety. This system, in a nutshell, helps to correct any errors in the output that automotive systems may generate. These systems are, one, modify original data. Two, input each modified data or images that are being received into a model. Derive the output at step three. And at step four, compare the output to determine the proper course of action. The future will use quantum computing in this situation to calculate these outcomes in the lightning-quick environment of driving. In basic terms, XAI will allow AI to analyze the content of an environment and assess accordingly. For example, a ball and a squirrel are the same size. Tell the system to don't stop because there's a squirrel, slow down based on the speed, and avoid the small adjustment if necessary. Stop for the ball, there's a kid running to get it. These are the different examples that the AI would have to face. AI will also need to be able to ethically make decisions, pushing the parameters of cybersecurity and safety to new limits. Code for AI algorithms and machine learning will not only need to be impeccably precise, but will also need to be properly configured for the considerations of not just the passengers, but the surrounding environment. That environment will need to be altered to help the AI system to control decision making. This will mean massive infrastructure changes to allow for the AI to be able to operate within safety parameters, laws, and policy. So how does this translate to the book that I'm writing? Well, this story does take place in the future. AI Fully Autonomous Traffic Network, or AFATN, will be utilized on specific roads and surfaces that are designed specifically for the system. This story does take place in a city that is being tested, the entire city is being tested for the system. Roads are specially built with specific features that the AI system will utilize for driving. The AI program will rely on three deep learning machine programs. In the book, one is based on the moral machine, one is based on the XAI method of determining safety, and one on a regulatory approach designed by Australian scientists to make decisions based on sensor algorithms. The security flaw in the program is based on the backup systems that the automobiles will rely on. The systems connect to the AI support that the automobiles rely on, as onboard computers will be too expensive to process. Although by then, who knows? Another flaw that will end up being part of the downfall of the story. The flaw will dump command to vehicles' less intuitive control systems that are not powerful enough to complete the normal AI modes. The system will only hand over control to the user or the driver when an emergency is declared, if backup systems do not. Let's move on to autonomous vehicles. Today, we already have partially autonomous vehicles. I'm sure that everyone has, at some point, if you've driven a brand new vehicle, experienced that in some form or way. Right now, the SAE classifies 6 levels of autonomous driving. Level 0 is for cars that are not autonomous at all. Levels 1, 2, and 3 in the blue, level 0, 1, and 2 in blue, have the driver engage in the actual driving, and the auto motion is assisting the driver. This is kind of what we see today in our cars. Levels 4 and 5 in green have the driver not really driving that much in at all, especially level 5. Fully autonomous vehicles end up in level 5, where the feature can drive the vehicle under all conditions. This is where using AI algorithms will help keep drivers and passengers safe, and pedestrians around them. Security with autonomous vehicles. Legal registration and the Automotive Information Sharing and Analysis Center is not enough to reach SAE level 4 or 5. The future of these autonomous vehicles is dependent on many things beyond acceptance of the masses. Legal legislation would need to be enacted to allow for the trusted technology being used to ensure safety for pedestrians. From 2017 to 2019, the 115th Congress could not even come to an agreement on the Autonomous Vehicle Act. The focus was that the legislation should contain more content relating to the cybersecurity threats that surround autonomous vehicles. Driver data will need to be protected in the situations, including input, images, sensor data, locations, insurance, owners, or occupants, crash testing, and anything else that can be used. Think about when you're driving down the road. If a camera's in your car, maintaining the visual appearance of your face to make sure you're staying on the road, it's taking pictures of you, and those are being uploaded to big data. As it stands, we currently need legislation to protect the data from hackers. Right now, as of 2021, cars have up to 150 million lines of code in them, with 1 to 3 defects per 1,000 lines. The number of software defects from 2005 to 2010 and further on to 2015 has gone up. UN regulations 115 and 116 dictate that vehicle cybersecurity should be designed into vehicles from the beginning of stages of development. They should be able to withstand cyber attacks, and cybersecurity should be tested throughout the lifetime of the vehicle. How does this translate to my story? Well, in the future, the security of autonomous driving systems is locked down as a computer would be, or even stronger. Security risks in code. Code is thoroughly inspected at the highest security levels in the book. It's checked using modern print statements, error handling, debugging tools, tests, and AI tools like TensorWatch. Systems are updated live prior to the vehicle shutdown. However, quantum computing, remember, this is deep into the future, and 7G, just guessing because we're at 5G now, speeds allow this to happen blindingly fast. All sensors and systems and cameras are protected on an internal automotive system. Standards are set by the Auto ISAC Protect Data and Information with Data Sensors Monitoring, and the ground-up approach to cybersecurity surrounds vehicle autonomous systems. Main character's world, which is the entire city, they'll have fully autonomous level 5 vehicles that drive themselves. The infrastructure will be changed in a way that all rural parts and in the city will be paved in a similar fashion, yet different approaches to traffic patterns are utilized. Agreed upon sensors, signals, signs, indicators, and other traffic tools will be installed and utilized. These road utilities will allow for automated vehicles to track along. Think of how you see a stop sign now. Your car will pick up on different signs along the side of the road, telling them where they are, how far they're going. This is in case GPS can't track it. It's almost like a backup system. The main character will be working for a corrupt organization that cornered the market for these vehicles and the AI that supports them. However, the AI is sold to other car manufacturers too. Years of infrastructure changes and approvals, along with modernizing existing vehicles to keep up, have taken place already. The cell phone tower security in this story is a minor part of it. Right now, cell phone towers rely on base transceiver stations. This is a universal thing, no matter whether it's on GSM, UMTS, or LTE. These stations rely on a power source, whether it's in the building or it's attached to a generator substation to the transmitter. Renewable energy can be used here as well, such as solar. However, these are very much at risk. For example, certain vendors and their software, for example, Legbda Incorporated, over millions of ranges in multiple places, are already vulnerable at different levels. Attackers can take advantage of the device's built-in features by sending UDP packets to certain management ports, specifically 5700, 5701, and 5702. This allows the attacker to take control of the BTS station, removing information from passing data, making changes to the GSM traffic, or crash the entire station. How does this translate to my story? Well, in the novel, connection is lost from satellites from the vehicles, and when a connection is lost, the AI support is lost. The vehicle will rely on a redundant measurement and connect to cell towers in the city that will provide the AI support temporarily. While cell phone towers are vulnerable in many areas, the story will focus on a more basic vulnerability. The power connection for each station that are powered by a subsidiary of the automotive company that develops the cars. Hackers will place a time bomb devices in those to shut down the cell towers, rendering the vehicles and the AI unusable. Before we finish, let's discuss ethics real quick. This is a fictional story. All the theoretical hacker methods are real. The ethics of bringing level 5 autonomous vehicles to the forefront of reality are ethically challenging. As the moral machine has taught us, the reality of how to judge real-world decisions in the blink of an eye are challenging. Crash optimizing will require targeting in situations where there is no other choice. Grandma or child, motorcycle or SUV, protect passengers or protect the pedestrians. Which one will the system choose? Futures like this one proposed have to have strict regulations on where these roads are, speed limits are in the areas, and who's allowed to drive manual vehicles in this situation. We are still in a technological adolescence for autonomous vehicles. Bringing the story together. The plot. Our story finds the main character struggling. The city is where the AI fully autonomous traffic network is being utilized fully before national and global launch. The character development aside, let's look at how the hackers group attacks. In their first stage, like any hacker, enumeration for all information for the hijacking is done. This stage will not be truly revealed until later on in the story. However, it is revealed that, like many cyber incidents, it's done by the inside individuals to the company. In the second stage, payoffs to internal techs to set up time bombs in each of the cell towers. They have payload code developed at satellites to cut off signals to the cars via a broadcast signal intrusion, set up a same time bomb schedule. Satellite interruption is only to stop the signal, not to steal traffic across the satellite signals. In the third stage, satellites are cut off, automobiles cannot connect to the cell towers, and right before the cell towers shut down, a polymorphic virus is transmitted to all the vehicles throughout the back door in the automotive software. The cell towers shut down, and a virus cuts off emergency controls to the drivers, locks doors, and commits them to driving on an average of 40 miles in random routes. The fourth stage starts. Hijackers demand ransom to release the users. The speed increases every 5 miles per hour for 30 minutes at a time. Cell towers can be fixed individually, but if certain cars stop, others will crash into them. This is where the story plot I'm revealing will end. There is a twist, though. These hijackers are just a front. The traffic being held hostage allows for routes across the city to be controlled, allowing for different crimes to be committed. Can anyone guess what it is? How will the main character know what to do? Bonus, by the way, I have not decided on a main character name, and I'm 2 chapters in. I pretty much had every time this guy talks, just a symbol, an asterisk in the book. I eventually have to replace it. Any ideas? Email me with a good name if you have it. Anyway, that's my basis for the story, and I still have to do a lot of research to really dial in a lot of the technical stuff throughout the book. As it is right now, I also don't have a title for it, but I'm a few chapters in and a lot of work to go. So that's my masterclass, and thank you everybody for listening. I do have references here, by the way, if anyone would like to see them.
Hey, great job, Michael. Excellent. You know, that really puts a damper on my wanting to buy a Tesla.
You could still buy a Tesla.
You rethink that one.
You could still buy a Tesla.
And another thing, a great character name would be Nathan. I mean, for sure.
There you go.
Oh, you know? Come on. I see where you're going with that. No, but this was a love of labor and a labor of love for me, and I had been doing a lot of thinking about it, and I'm really going to try to get this novel finished in the next year or so. So thank you, everybody.
And
for
when listening. You do, I want a copy.
Oh, everyone's going to get one.
Signed copy.
Yes.
A signed copy.
That's right.
Got it.
Yeah. Great job. Great job.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, great job. Awesome. So now we
David,
have
you're up next.
Yep, yeah. David, investigative techniques for forensic cybersecurity.
Everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep, awesome. Okay.
Are you on mute, David? We can't hear you.
No, I'm still here. I think it froze. Let's see.
Gotcha.
Oh, there we go. It does not want to share my computer. I'm not sure why.
You want to pop out and pop back in again?
Yeah, give me just one second.
Marjorie, he popped out, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah.
Is it showing anything at this point?
Not yet.
How about now?
Yes, I see your camera.
Perfect. Can you see this one?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Awesome. So like Marjorie said, I'm going to be doing mine on investigative techniques for forensic cybersecurity. I think that, you know, hearing from professionals that are in the field, is super important. And so, what we're first going to hear from is an individual that has done his time within the forensics field. And he's going to share a quick story of how he investigated an issue that was going on within some businesses. And so I'll kind of let him take it away for here for a few minutes. Can everybody hear that okay?
Not yet.
How's that?
No, still no sound.
There's no sound? Hmm.
During your share, do you have it set to use your system audio?
Good now.
Give company, go to a competitor.
There you go.
In a particular case, this guy didn't return key to an investigation. So I want to share just a quick example with you, a case that I worked on recently. Some of you may be familiar with this type of scenario. We have a guy who works at a company, and he decides to leave the company, go to a competitor. Now, in this particular case, this guy didn't return the computer, his work computer, to his original company until 1 week after he left, which raised suspicion. So he sent this computer back. The original company had it forensically analyzed, and they found two things. The first thing is that the laptop had thousands of deleted work-related files on there, which is not a good start. The second thing that they found was that there was an external hard drive plugged in just 2 days before the laptop was returned. And through their analysis of the link files, the jump lists, and the MRUs, they were able to determine that there were quite a few files on this USB hard drive that shouldn't have been there. Files which had the same names and occasionally dates and times as those found on the deleted files found on the laptop. So they obviously weren't very happy, and I apologize for the language. So they weren't very happy about this. They got a lawyer involved, and they sent a request back to this guy, and they asked, we want this external hard drive. So the guy obliged, he sent it back, and further analysis was done. And the analyst found that, unfortunately, every single one of those deleted files from the laptop existed on this external hard drive. So this was a bit problematic. And the conclusion that they came to after they spoke to their employees, that this guy was not very technically adept, okay? He was not an everyday computer user. People said he could do his email, search the web, do some spreadsheet stuff, but that was it. So the most interesting thing about this external hard drive was not that all these files existed on there, but the timestamps associated with them. The created time was preserved at the time of copy. This event happened in December of last year. And if you refer back to your SANS poster, you'll see that file copying or drag and drop preserves only one timestamp, the last written time. But in this case, the last written time and the creation time are both preserved. So, given that this guy was not hugely into computing and these dates and times have been preserved, the forensic analyst made a bit of a conclusion. And that is that in the week that he had this laptop, he took it into his new place of work, they had an IT person at this company load up some specialist copying software, copied those files onto the external hard drive, deleted those files, and then sent the laptop back. It's an interesting hypothesis. So they did, after they got the results of this analysis, they sent notices to the new company, and they added them to the list of defendants. Not happy at all with this scenario. So what did they do? Well, they went and hired a forensic analyst of their own, and that's where I come in. And so I took a look at the external hard drive to start with, and I saw pretty much the same thing as the other guy, that all the created and last written times were exactly as they were found on the deleted files. So potentially, yeah, I mean, you could say that specialist copying software was used here. But then if it was, why are only half the times preserved? Why not the other half? Maybe some settings, maybe not. Well, let's have a look. So I went and looked at the file name attributes, and they were all exactly the same. And they all reflected the time that this transfer of data took place. So now I've got 8 MAC times to look at. So I went back to my trusty SANS poster. And knowing that the last written and the created time were preserved, but all of the other dates and times were updated, we could narrow this down potentially to a volume file move. Now, two questions from this. What's a volume file move? And why potentially? Well, volume file move, really, really straightforward and simple. It's you have a window open over here for one drive. You right click, select cut. You go over to another drive, you right click and select paste. That simple. It's a cut and paste. Okay. Now, if that's the case, then all this stuff about the specialist copying software is all in the heads. And that's what we want to prove. Now, why potentially? Well, we've only looked at half of the evidence. We haven't looked at the external hard drive. So let's take a look at the laptop. Well, if this is a cut and paste, the key thing that we're going to look at here is we want to see that a cut is going to delete the files at the exact same time that they're copied to the external hard drive. So, we want to find out when those files were deleted. Now, here's the rub, is that file deletion, and people always say this isn't true, file deletion is not recorded in the MFT. Okay? The time that the file is deleted, you will not find from the Mac times. And I get people saying, anyway, I posted this the other day and I got like a flood of emails. And it's not true. It's true. Okay, just deal with it. So we want to look at somewhere where we're going to get these file deletion times from. So we're stepping out of the MFT for just a moment and we're going to look at the USN journal. And so here we've got all the stuff from the file name attributes, all the dates and times, and we want to make sure that for each file, each and every single one of these thousands of files, that when it appeared on the USB hard drive is the exact same time that it was deleted from the laptop. And because I'm standing up here talking about this, you probably already figured out, they matched up perfectly. So we now went from our hunch that this was a cut and paste to it was definitely a cut and paste. So we went and we also looked for evidence of the specialist copying software being used, and as you may well have guessed, there was nothing. So we went back to the court. We said, look, this is the evidence we have. The court agreed. The opposition was forced to concede, and they removed my client from the list of defendants. So they were very, very happy about this. So the one thing that I just want to touch on quickly is that frequently when we do investigations, we find one thing, and it sets us on course. Now, good investigators will alter course when they see more evidence. I'm not going to say bad investigators because it happens to everyone, but probably less experienced investigators will not course correct when they see evidence which contradicts what they believe. It's so important that we let the evidence speak for itself and that we just become the mouthpiece. We can't let our own agendas affect what we put in our reports. So That's the end of that.
All right. So as we heard from this gentleman, you know, there's a lot that goes into analyzing and determining what actually happened during an event. And that's what a forensic investigator is required to do, is to find all of those different steps all the way until they can come up with a firm, solid conclusion based off of what the evidence is showing. This is the same type of investigation process that goes not only from the forensic side of cybersecurity, but through almost every investigative process through law enforcement or FBI or anything else like that. It's all just about the same. So as we go through here, there we go. So the first thing that I want to do is kind of go over the different situations that you might run into as a forensics analyst. As we go through these different ones, I want you to kind of think of the different tasks that are created from these analysis and what kind of they all have to do within each other. So there's different processes that you're doing, right? Because network forensics or whatever other things that you'll be doing as a forensics analyst. But it's almost the same thing each time, the same steps, the same processes. It's just maybe doing things a little bit differently. So the first one that I want to touch base on is with network forensics. So network forensics involve the collection, preservation, analysis, and presentation of network data for the purpose of investigating and preventing network-based cyber attacks. It's a critical component of incident response, digital forensics, and can be used to identify the source, nature, and scope of the security incident. To do that, they go through these few steps. So data collection, this involves capturing and preserving network traffic and other relevant data, such as log files, system images, and configuration files. Data analysis, this involves analyzing and collecting data to identify patterns, anomalies, malicious activity. This can be done manually or through specialized tools such as network protocol analyzers and so on. Evidence preservation, this includes preserving the collected data and any relevant information in a matter that would be admissible in court. So as we heard from this individual before, going to court is kind of a big deal. It's something that you, as a forensics analyst, that's probably going to be your end goal, is to end up in court in front of a judge. And so in order to make sure that you know what you're talking about, you need to report everything that happens. So this involves documenting the findings of the investigation, providing a detailed report on the incident, including recommendations for preventing similar incidents in the future. If you're working for a company, giving them those, this is what happened, this is why our network got hit, and this is how we can fix it, is going to be a big step on that. Network forensics can be used to investigate a wide range of cyber attacks, including DOS attacks, man-in-the-middle attacks, the advanced persistent threats. It can also be used to identify and track the activities of malicious actors, such as hackers and cyber criminals. It's worth mentioning that in order to have a successful network forensics investigation, it's important to have a well-defined incident response plan and have a dedicated team of experts that can handle the collection, preservation, and analysis of the data collected. And the next one that we're going to go over is malware analysis. So malware analysis is the process of dissecting and examining malware samples to understand how they work, what they do, and where they came from. I almost feel like this is like the biology of tech. And so the goal of malware analysis is to identify the malware's behavior, capabilities, and potential vulnerabilities, which can be used to improve security measures and protect against future attacks. The process of malware analysis is as we go here. First one is obtainment. So you need to get the malware, obviously. You can run a honeypot to lure it in. You can capture it as it transits through the network. Static analysis at that point is the process of analyzing the malware without executing it. So this is code review, examining the malware's code structure and other characteristics to identify its functionality, communication patterns, and potential vulnerabilities. This is a big step on what they found out with WannaCry. After they stood up a domain, and it called back to that domain and actually completely terminated WannaCry. They went back and looked through its code and determined that that's what inevitably stopped WannaCry from wiping through the entire world. So then dynamic analysis, that's actually turning it on and observing its behavior and see what it creates, and files it modifies, what network connections it tries to establish, which is what WannaCry was doing. It was calling back to that domain. And then reverse engineering it, taking it apart, understanding how it works, disassembling its binary code, analyzing the assembly code, and then back to the reporting, right? So we need to document all the findings of the analysis, including the malware's behavior, capabilities, and potential vulnerabilities. Once it's complete, you can improve security measures, because now you understand what that malware is trying to do and how it gets in. That's one of the nice things about the honeypot, is that you can create essentially a trap that it will weave through your network, and then you can see how it runs through your network. And then you can block it because you understand all of that type of stuff. One of the big things to get out of this is whenever you're working with malware, make sure it's on a closed network and within a closed environment, a lab-based environment, to make sure that you don't spread it further. Like WannaCry, that one was a bad one. All right, so log analysis. So this is the logs that could be created within a network, such as firewalls, intrusion detection systems, and web servers to investigate security incidents. Log data could provide valuable information about security-related events, such as successful and failed login attempts, network activity, and system changes. First, we need to collect all that data, right? So gathering log data from various systems and devices, such as servers, network devices, and security devices. Data normalization, this includes converting the log data into a standard format, so that way you can actually analyze it. Using systems such as Elasticsearch, LogRhythm, Splunk, ArcSight, QRadar, and RSA Security Analytics. It's how you can do that. This involves data analysis. Examine the log data, identify patterns, anomalies, suspicious activity. You can use specialized software for that as well. Correlation, this involves combining log data from different sources to build a comprehensive picture of the incident. This step allows for the identification of potential malicious activity that might have been missed by looking at the data just in isolation. And then reporting, always going back to that reporting, right? This involves documenting the findings of the analysis and providing a detailed report of the incident, including recommendations for preventing similar incidents in the future. Log analysis can be used to investigate wide ranges of security incidents, such as network intrusions, data breaches, insider threats. It can also be used to identify and track activities of malicious actors. All right, memory forensics. We'll go through this one quickly, but this is analyzing the computer's RAM, identifying investigative security incidents. So acquisition, right? This includes capturing a snapshot of the computer's memory, which can be done by specialized software tools, such as memory dumpers, or by physically removing the memory modules from the computer. Memory analysis, this includes analyzing the memory dump to identify patterns, anomalies, and malicious activity. This can be done manually or with the aid of specialized software tools. And then evidence preservation. This includes preserving the memory dump and any relevant information in a manner that's admissible in court. You don't want that RAM to just dump all that information out. And so you need to keep it to where you can actually analyze it. And then reporting again, right? So memory forensics can be investigated. A wide range of security incidents, such as malware infections, data breaches, and insider threats. All right, investigative techniques. So we've gone through all these different things to kind of show you this is how they're used in the real world. Now getting down to the commonalities between all of those different situations. So as you can tell, there's a lot of commonalities. You need to have a good response team, the search and seizure, evidence collection, securing the evidence, data acquisition and data analysis, assessing and documentation, and then expert witnesses. All right, this is a kind of a flow chart of what a normal response team would look like for an incident. These teams are highly trained individuals who work together to gather, determine what is and isn't evidence to a cyber attack. One of the things that I want to really focus on here is that, as you can see, the forensics team is right in between the InfoSec and the legal team. So they understand somebody who's a good investigator really understands both sides of the house. They understand how to gather all the data and how to do all the InfoSec side of things. But the other side of it, they understand what legal issues can come about from gathering that information, what legal issues can come about with documentation, the processes that are required for it, and how they're going to give that to a judge in a later date. So if there's anybody out there that's looking to be a forensics analysis, just know that you will probably end up in court at some point and sit in front of a judge. All right, so search and seizure. This is the task of making sure that everything that is determined as evidence is gathered and legally seized. This legality comes from the Fourth Amendment within the United States. The team of forensic cybersecurity specialists want to get information that is not from their client, and they need to obtain search warrants and work closely with the police. This also includes determining what devices, logs, or code that will need to be analyzed and determine where the evidence could be. A lot of forensics and analysts work with police departments. There's inside of many states, there's forensics teams that go out with police to analyze computers, analyze hard drives, do all of that stuff. I actually have a buddy that recently was on a case that they had to deal with a lot of computer crime issues. And so the state sent out the forensics team. They drove up with this really cool big van, and they just looked at the officers and were like, hey, bring us computers. And they started walking computers out. They used their big van with all their huge tech that's in there and just started analyzing everything right there in the driveway. And as they started gathering more and more information, they were able to determine which devices it wanted to keep and take to their state lab, which ones were not necessary, and then get all that put together. One of the big things with this is making sure that anything that's the fruit of the poisonous tree, as they call it within law enforcement, doesn't happen. So if you do one thing that isn't correct, anything after that will not be admissible in court. So like an officer who illegally searches a car, right? They don't get permission, they don't have a warrant, whatever. Anything that they find inside of that vehicle is not admissible in court. And so then there becomes an issue. This can happen as well within forensics, cybersecurity. So going to the evidence collection, this is where I have the fruit of the poisonous tree as well. Making sure that the evidence is collected in a clean manner. If any of the evidence ends up in court, they'll need to have a chain of custody starting from the collection to court. This also includes methods of evidence that's obtained, whether through programs such as Splunk, SleuthKit, Cellebrite, UFVD. The program will need to collect the evidence without tampering with it. So having a good log of this, we found this at this house at this time period, it was brought to the state lab, it was put away, whatever. This will, even in the private sector, this is something that needs to be maintained. Due to like what he was saying, right? And the gentleman that at the beginning of this was saying that they had all of this information, but if any of that was changed or there was any issues in that time period, well, then that data is no longer good anymore. And so making sure that we preserve that information and don't tamper with it as it goes along and knowing who is dealing with it, which is that chain of custody, right? Because you might collect it in 1 month, and then 2 months later, you might be analyzing it. Who had it in that time period? Where was it? That goes back to our securing of the evidence. Along with the collection of the evidence, it needs to be secured, and the chain of custody needs to be followed. If any further analysis, if the data happens, then all that needs to be logged in case of tampering that could happen. All evidence should be secured so that no one can access it without their access being logged, whether digitally or physically. So, we have here a locker, right? Somebody has to log in and say, I want this device from this locker. And so now there's a log saying who had it at what time. All right, data acquisition and data analysis. This goes hand in hand. When an investigator receives data from either a device or stored logs, they need to ensure the data has not been altered in any way. Subsequently, any analysis needs to be done without affecting the evidence. It allows the identification and conversion of the data to be used within court, whether other proceedings might follow. Assessing and documentation. Assessing the data brings you to a point where you can determine what the data means and why it's important to the case. As you find these correlations, they need to be documented for future use. So documentation is key to the investigation. If you have made great finds within your analysis, but you can't document it well, then you've really done nothing. There's something that they always told us in law enforcement, that if it wasn't written down, that never happened. So document everything, make sure that what your experience is documented, any analysis that you find, where you have it, what systems you use, everything. needs to be documented and written down. And then the big one, right? The expert witness. So after you've gathered all of that information, after you've done all of everything that you done your full analysis, eventually you're going to have to tell somebody about it, whether it be within your company saying, hey, we know that Billy Joe was tampering with our network. You know, you need to be that expert witness to your company to say, hey, this is why we think that this happened. This is why this is the evidence that we have behind it, all of that. Or if you decide to go governmental side, you need to be able to tell the judge what happened. And even with this guy who worked within the private sector, he still ended up in front of a judge saying, here's our evidence. This is what's going on. This is why I'm an expert on this material. Just remember that imposter syndrome is very real. You can believe that maybe I don't know everything on this or whatever else, but you're still the expert if you did the analysis. So this is when you're called to proclaim to the world that you found and the techniques that you use to do it eventually. Do it. Eventually, you'll be called to testify. If there are criminal or civil litigation, be prepared by following the process and documenting everything really well. So I just want to thank everybody for your time. If you have any questions or anything like that, I'd be happy to answer anything.
Hey, David. Excellent, man. Excellent. Excellent. I do have one question. Mm-hmm. Now, when you are a technical, an expert witness, do you need to be certified in the tools that you use to collect that evidence in order to be an expert witness on the stand?
Well, not technically. It makes it more reliable. So especially like if you're in like a jury trial or you're even just talking to the judge and the judge is going to make the decision, those kind of back up your knowledge. And the defense will probably work really hard to make you sound dumb.
Yeah, discredit.
Kind of their job. I get that. And so if having those credentials behind you help you to be like, no, I do know what I'm talking about, done this 1,000 times, I have these credentials. However, you can still be an expert in anything at any time inside of court. So you can be an expert about any type of analysis that you do, even if it's, you know, a system that you don't know as well, as long as you're able to say, this is how I did it and this is how it worked, you're an expert at that point.
Gotcha. One more question before I let you go. Do you inspect the original evidence, or as an analyst, do you pull a copy of this evidence?
So I think that depends on what you're analyzing, right? Like this individual here, if he had pulled a copy, there's potential that things could have changed.
True.
There's things in the metadata that could be different, whatever else. And so I think it's really depends on what you're doing, like the RAM, right? You can pull that information off of the RAM and leave the RAM where it is, or you can completely remove it and analyze it while it's still on the RAM. And so there's different routes, different methods. So I think it just depends on what you decide within your analysis.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Von Erich Young is next, and he's going to give us a little bit of an insight on virtualization. Von Erich, you're up, buddy.
Hello, can everyone hear me?
Yep.
Awesome. So my presentation may not be as exciting as automated cars and incident testing, but I did my best. Hold on, let me share my screen real quick. All right, are you guys able to see?
Yes, sir, we can.
Uh-oh. Give me 1 minute. 1 minute. Not sure how to get the master slide. There's an actual. I found it.
Okay.
All right. So what is virtualization? Virtualization is a method of operating computer technology within a sandboxed environment. And there's actually a lot of use cases for virtualization that perhaps maybe you don't know about. A lot of people look at virtualization as like an enterprise thing, but there's definitely some things you can do with virtualization at home. They are much more scalable than using purely physical hardware because you are not confined to space limitations. So one of the big advantages of virtualization is obviously you can run multiple operating systems on one piece of hardware. So instead of needing to separate all of your different tasks, you can create many different virtual machines that have a lot of different use cases. Virtualization gives computing many more possibilities because these virtual machines can be created for a single task, and they can also be discarded when you no longer need them. So what are some of the advantages to virtualization? There are many practical uses for virtualization. The biggest one is obviously they create a sandboxed environment. This doesn't necessarily have to be something for enterprise use. It's also for research. They can be used for personal reasons. For you cybersecurity guys, a big thing in the field for virtualization is malware testing. So you can spin up a virtual machine. You can throw some malware in it. You can see how that malware interacts with Windows. You can see how it interacts with, Mac or Linux. You can see if the malware is even looking to see if it's being run in a virtual machine and trying to hide itself. So you can actually learn a lot about a malware by throwing it in a virtual machine. In software development, they have a practical use as well. You can ensure a program can be run on a base machine that you just installed, like Windows, for example, and make sure it doesn't require any additional dependencies to run. This is important because you want the end user experience to be as easy as possible. You want them to know if they need to install additional software. Somewhat related, a method I've been using for this entire internship is I'm using a virtual machine to get everything done. And this is because I use my personal machine. It has, it has emails. It has, I do music stuff. I play games on it. And I don't want those distractions when I'm working. So it kind of helps me to still have the convenience of using my desk computer, but I can access remote work. Let's see, efficient utilization of available resources. VMs offer a single machine the capacity to run multiple operating systems at once. Each of these operating systems can be scaled down so that the VMs don't use more resources than they need, although you can also give them more resources because they're only going to use what they need, kind of thing. This allows you to save money on buying additional hardware per client and server. And as I said in the very beginning, it just helps with physical space. It costs, you don't have to buy multiple pieces of hardware to run different operating systems and do different things with them. And then another big benefit of virtual machines, if a VM fails for any reason at all, you can simply restore it. If you've made proper backups, or like in my use cases, if I'm just running a virtual machine for a single thing, such as desktop. If a VM fails for whatever reason, if I break it doing something, I can just reinstall a fresh operating system, and there's no downtime. Like if you have a hardware failure, then obviously that's a little more annoying to fix than, you know, a VM failure. So that's pretty nice about VMs. So what are some of the disadvantages of virtualization? Some workloads obviously will require powerful hardware. And this also depends on how many virtual machines you're running and what you're doing with them. Virtualization isn't a magical bullet that fires out new computers. They still require real hardware resources. So if you're running a lot of virtual machines, you're obviously going to need a lot of CPU power. You're going to need a lot of RAM. And in some cases, you might even need graphics processing. Because of this, they are slower than machines running on bare metal, especially Type 2 hypervisors, which I'll get into in the next slide. And finally, I guess this probably doesn't affect most of us here, especially if we are familiar with operating systems and networking, but they're not always plug and play, especially if you're running like a niche use case for a virtual machine. You may run into compatibility issues that only affect certain hardwares. And that can be annoying. It's sometimes difficult to determine that that is the case. And depending on what you're doing, how niche your issues are, you may be able to find forum help, but you still can come into common problems such as different hardware acting in different ways when you virtualize. So sometimes there are some things that there is no one-size-all solution. The biggest recent example that comes to mind is trying to game on virtual machines. There's a lot of documentation about this, especially in Linux gaming. There's a robust community kind of trying to make gaming on Linux viable, especially in VMs, because Linux gaming isn't up to par with Windows. A lot of games aren't written for Linux. They're not even written with Linux in mind, especially like older games. And there's easily more failure stories than success stories in that case, which speaks to how virtualization is very dependent on hardware in these niche kinds of scenarios. All right, so types of virtualization. We have type 1 hypervisors, which are kind of like your hardware virtualization. These are your it's referred to as bare metal because these kind of virtual machines run directly on your machine's hardware. So they'll directly use your machine CPU. They'll directly use your RAM, your graphics card. And these are generally a lot stronger than a Type 2 hypervisor because these actually run as a software layer. Common Type 2 hypervisors are Qemu/KVM, which is, I believe, Linux only. VMware Player and Workstation work on Windows and Linux. And VirtualBox also work on Windows and Linux. Qemu is completely open source, and for some people, that is a big deal. VirtualBox is open source, but it has optional extensions that are closed source. And VMware, as far as I was able to determine, is completely closed source, but it is freeware, so you are free to use it without paying for a license, as long as you are not using it for commercial use. And on this slide, you can see I just have a Windows 10 virtual machine. I was installing that and a Linux machine on the right. And I have a video presentation that's about 4.5 minutes long, and that'll be mostly it. Please let me know if you guys have found. Sorry for the graphical glitches. Can you guys hear it?
Not yet.
Okay. It took a little bit for some audio, but if you guys can't hear it, I can just mute it and narrate it over it myself.
Yeah, we're still without sound.
So basically, okay. So basically, in this video demonstration, I've already installed Windows 10, and I've installed a Linux distribution on the right. And we are going to open up a command prompt. We're going to determine the IP address. And then to end this demonstration, I will make sure that the pings can see each other and they're set up on a physical network. So right now, I just installed Windows 10 and we're using VMware. So on VMware, myself, because that's a little distracting. So in VMware, it's automatically configured to use NAT routing, which is fine for internal stuff. It's, for most cases, probably good enough. But as you can see, it's giving me a random IP address that's not my network IP address. My network IP address isn't 192.168.70. It's 192.168.1. And so I need to go into the upper left tab and hit player, configure virtual machine, and then change the network adapter to bridged, and also replicate a physical network connection state. And also, since my computer is running in Ethernet, I have to configure the adapter that VMware is going to use. So it automatically defaulted to my Wi-Fi adapter, but again, that's not what I want, so I have to click the Ethernet. Let's fast forward a little bit here. And then as a little bit of a proof of concept, I ran ipconfig/all again, and you can see now it is connected to the physical network, and it was assigned an IP address for my router. And this IP address is routable on my physical network. And then I just did the same thing on my Linux distribution. Again, sorry for these graphics glitches. So on Linux, I ran /IP/addr for IP address, and it shows 192.168.1.137. So I know that that is a network address for my physical network. And then I just run ping, make sure that they can see each other. And as soon as I get the test, I know that they are physically connected to my network. And obviously, there are additional use cases where you might also need to change firewall settings or change like antivirus settings. But, you know, for a simple connecting to the network test, the ping test was fine for the demonstration.
Good job.
And then for the last slide. Thank you. In conclusion, we learned why virtualization can benefit the individual as opposed to simply just being a tool for organizational use. We learned a bit how different hardware and operating systems can react differently on virtual machines, so they won't always work in every scenario. And we learned basic virtual networking with a popular virtualization software, which was VMware. And that's it.
Question about that. For
all right, shoot.
you're normally on a host machine. I mean, usually attackers use a virtual machine to attack other networks and computer systems. Where are you getting your storage from? Like your page space?
Where are you getting your storage from? So it differs a little bit, depending on what virtualization software you are using. But they all kind of operate in the same way.
One of those two. Are they using RAM, or are they going to use your actual your host hard drive? It's definitely using RAM for page space.
Actually.
But it can also...
I can boot up my calendar quick. And actually show you some of those settings. So VMware, the reason I like to use it is it's really simple. Stuff like Qemu is a lot more flexible, but it's also a lot more advanced. It's a lot more hands-on in the command line. VMware is mostly a graphical tool, which is pretty nice. So you can allocate a certain file size for your storage space. So for my Windows 11 VM that I'm using for this internship, I have a 60 gigabyte file on my host computer that serves as that storage.
Dedicated.
And, okay,
gotcha.
Yeah. And then
how many cores you got? You can create
VMs that don't use storage at all. I'm sorry, go ahead.
How many cores you got running on it? You got dedicated to your machine?
For this virtual machine, I have 8 cores, I believe.
Okay. I see you're running two systems.
Yeah, so they're scalable. You can pick 1 to 8 cores. I have 32 gigabytes of RAM on my host machine. I have 16 dedicated for this virtual machine when it's up.
Nice.
Obviously, plenty.
And you just do your schoolwork and all that stuff in here?
Yeah, like I said, the reason I like virtualizing for like school and remote work and stuff is it just it gives me like a non-distracting environment. Right, because I just have what I'm using for this internship on my, like you can see on the left side, I only have like time clock stuff, shortcuts. I'm actually routing my mic through networking so you guys can hear it, just so I don't have to unplug my mic into the virtual machine every time I spin it up and then unplug it every time I turn it off, because that gets annoying.
Nice. Yeah, I got a billion virtual machines. Actually, we got a few flavors. If you want to take a look in our environment, we have a few flavors that I've dropped in. I think it's in SharePoint. I'll take a look at that, and when I find them, I will send you a link.
Awesome. I'd
there's be a few fun in, ones.
Looking at that.
Yeah, we got a couple of calendars.
It's nice. Yeah, virtualization nice and is convenient. Kind of one of those topics I learned about in college that like really interested me. And sorry if I keep stepping on you. Like I said, I'm routing my audio to my virtual machine for you guys can hear it. So there's a bit of delay when I actually talk and when you guys hear it. So.
Nah, don't worry about it. We're good.
Yeah, I apologize for that.
Nope, we're in good shape. Well, thank you, sir.
All right, but
learned a lot.
Yeah, thank you. That's my presentation.
All right, who's next? Let's see here. Von Erich, that's you, right? Sorry, guys. Von Erich, you just went. Evan, you're up next. Evan's going to give us a taste of load balancing. Let us know what load balancing is all about. And anybody working in the cloud, anybody networking, this is going to be a good topic.
Yeah. Thanks, Nate. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yep.
All right, perfect. I'm going to share my screen here. So load balancing is my topic. And give you a quick introduction here. What is load balancing? Most commonly, it'll act as a reverse proxy, and it can distribute, client requests between more than one server. Reverse proxy coming in, the client will request, it could be a web application through the internet, HTTPS, and it's going to hit your load balancer before it hits your servers. And, it does some cool things there for security and availability. So it's a pretty common implementation in, corporations, government agencies, and things like that, because they like to keep their sites online. And that kind of ties into why load balancing. If you have a security background, one of the first things that they kind of teach us is the CIA triad. That there's the confidentiality, got integrity, and then there's availability, which I think it probably doesn't get the most attention, but it's also a very important aspect of security. And, load balancing really enhances the availability of an application or a resource. And it can deliver the content to the end user in a way that also supports, server health. If there's an influx of users and there's only one server, bad things can happen. Pages can freeze, servers can crash, and depending on the importance of that application, can be very drastic impact on an organization's reputation, finances, etc. So implementing load balancing can distribute these requests to more than one server in a way that, is predefined and can ensure that the servers remain in a healthy state and online. As kind of mentioned, the subject of my presentation will be F5. There's also some cloud load balancing, which I'm not as, familiar with, but F5 does some really cool stuff. They're kind of an industry leader in load balancing. And these are three of the common ways that you can distribute the requests. Round robin, which is, the one that I'm most familiar with and what I've seen. It's, you have three servers. It'll just kind of go around and around and around. There's no other characteristics or determining factors other than just, kind of a random fashion that it'll distribute the request. But there's also least connections. Say server A has, 1,000 connections, server B is 100. And then I go to browse the page, it's going to send me to server B. And then there's also least response time, checking to see the response time of the server. And it kind of, as you would imagine, shortest response time, it'd probably send you there first. All that kind of ties back into server health, keeping applications online, and keeping the end users happy and the company or organization or agency happy. And there are some free resources out there, like free and, trials, I would say, but I didn't pay any money to set this up. And if you're interested in setting up something like this to experiment with load balancing, you could reach out to me and I can provide you with those resources that I used. But what we are using for the lab, F5 Big IP development license. I'm not using the most up-to-date version, but it's not exposed, at a great deal. So that should be fine. And then it kind of ties into Von Erich's presentation. We're actually using both Workstation and ESXi. And you might wonder why. it doesn't make sense a whole lot off the sound of it to use two hypervisors. But it's because I did all of this on my kind of personal computer. And I obviously I have Windows installed, so I can't just throw on ESXi without really adjusting things. So I just, you know, the most easiest approach was to install Workstation as a type 2. And then on top of that, you install ESXi, kind of nested virtualization. And that lets you kind of simulate a more of a production environment, you know, where ESXi would be right on a server. And on top of that, you could have, you know, your F5 installed, you know, your servers and things like that. We're also using, you know, a trial version of Windows 10 and then training servers. And these are actually provided by F5. And so this was the basically the topology, the layout. I'm not going to go too in depth here, but it does show you how, you know, this would be my host system. Then we got Workstation installed. This is my LAN. And then we got ESXi installed, and that's where the magic happens. We have F5 bridged on the management network. This is your Windows 10 virtual machine installed inside of ESXi, which also has you know, two, you know, Ethernet adapters. Put a bridged IP there, that way you can RDP into it. And then it also has a second network, so it can communicate with the F5 itself through a virtual switch in ESXi. Down here, we have another virtual switch, which kind of these two switches is kind of the key here. We have an external network, which would kind of simulate, you know, the public, and then we have our internal network, and they're separated. To get to any resource on the internal network, it needs to go through F5. And that is the kind of reverse proxy we talked about. I'll go ahead and move on. And I do have a demonstration later, but just wanted to go over a few topics before we dive in there. F5 has virtual servers, and that is these servers are going to live on the external network, you know, and you can kind of give those an IP address based on the self IP, which is the VLAN. So you'll see here that my IP is 10.10.1.100, corresponds to, you know, your self IP here. And it could have really been anything, that at least it's 10.10, you know. And it probably looks foreign to you guys. Just focus up here in this spot. You know, we just had a source address, which is the zeros, meaning anything can access it. Destination, where is that going to? That's, you know, what the end user would type into their browser. Ideally, you'd have DNS involved and give them a host name, but just for the lab, we kept it as that. I didn't deal with any certificates. It would have really complicated things, so I just kept it as HTTP. And we can go ahead and move on. That's the virtual server. Pretty much give it a destination and give it a port, and you're good. And it's a virtual server because this is built on the F5. I could build 100 of these. You know, they're not necessarily real servers, but they kind of behave as one. And now each virtual server needs a pool. A pool of real servers, you know, things that the traffic is being serviced by. These training servers were provided by F5. Again, if you're interested in any of this, I can point you in the right direction. This is basically, you know, another virtual appliance that I imported in ESXi, and just really low maintenance. Really didn't have to interact with it other than typing in these IP addresses when I was adding the nodes. So, you know, you have your virtual servers, you have your pool, and it's good for you know, IT administrators and F5 admins to be able to quickly identify if a node is online, because this is kind of where that availability comes from. If we see anything going on with the status here, we can, you know, remediate that before it becomes an issue. And we do that through the use of health monitors inside of the pool. For this example, I used an HTTP health monitor. Most commonly that I use a TCP, you know, at work we would use a TCP, but I went ahead and did HTTP here. You can do different ones that will meet your needs, and just kind of summarized how it's determining the health, you know, with the HTTP request. It'll send a GET over there with the version specified by, you know, the F5 documentation and standards. It doesn't send a whole lot other than GET to the host, which would be the server IP here. And if it gets a good 200 response back, it gives you a green light there or there. TCP, you know, if you have that an IT background, you might be familiar with a three-way handshake. It's a little bit better of a way to make sure that those nodes are responding. But if the health's good and everything's configured correctly with the networking, and that kind of initial configuration's the hardest part, which that's usually done by, you know, it's usually already set up for you. You're just kind of maintaining applications on there. But once you do set up an application, you'll be able to see that traffic. And this is being presented by the nodes from our virtual server. This is a virtual server. And I do have a little demonstration. I recorded it because I have the two virtual machines on my computer while I was presenting. I went ahead and recorded it in advance because it is resource intensive. Here we go. There's no audio. But as you can see here, here's ESXi. We've got my servers, my Windows 10, my F5 Big IP. You can see the management network there. We went ahead and browsed to that 192.168.1.131. And there's the virtual server we're talking about. And it's pretty slow, but it'll come up here in just a second. Kind of see those characteristics I've showed you: source, destination, and port. Usually it'd be HTTPS and you'd have a cert on there. And then if you go to resources, you can actually see the pool assigned. And if you go to your pools, you can view that pool. And you can see your health monitor that was applied, and you can view the members. Check the status. Say node one was offline, you probably want to investigate that. Port 80 again. And if you remember, the Windows 10 was actually connected to our external network, which was on the side that, you know, our virtual server is going to reside on based on the self IP or the VLAN. And get rid of the developer tools. And you can see this. And as you might recall, the round robin that we mentioned, as you refresh, you'll see here, you know, server one is presenting our HTML serve from server two, it says. Again, server two. Then it's three. Server. Little discrepancy there, but the main thing is you can see, you know, it says HTML serve from server DNS 3. The main thing I just wanted you guys to get out of that is that the server that's servicing you, the traffic changes based on the round robin fashion. And I can actually force these nodes offline. Let's say these are vulnerable to security, you know, need a security patch. You can force those offline, let the server admins do what they need to do. And that's kind of where that redundancy goes through. Or let's say, you know, it's someone's first day and they messed up on the server, it takes it offline. You know, you still have one going on, and that application, as you can see, will still work, granted, just on one server. So that's where that availability comes in. Especially in a corporate environment, there's a lot of updates on servers. People are always, you know, patches are always getting installed, especially if it's Windows. And sometimes these can really break things and take things offline. So it's good to have redundancy whenever possible. And for some reason, if you get really unlucky, you're going to have a bad day. But if all servers go down, you'll kind of see that, you know, our health monitors are checking, not able to establish that HTTP connection or get that 200 response, and you'll see that red. And that's not a good thing unless you don't need that site anymore. And then if you try to refresh, you're going to be out of luck. And that's basically what I wanted to show you. So I'll take it back there. You know, that's basically it. If you guys have any questions, you can feel free to reach out to me. If you'd like to set this up yourself, you can send me a message and I'll provide you with the resources that I use to do that. But does anyone have any questions? I know it's a little late.
Evan, I got a question for you.
Uh-huh.
Now, this load balancing, when it comes to cloud, you know, like, yeah, say, for instance, our environment, I mean, on a scale here, we're talking like, let's say, for instance, you know, our server goes down, what happens?
Yeah, so if your server goes down, you know, if you're using a cloud resource, it would, I'm getting, you know, it'd be something similar. There's going to be other,
yeah,
you know, especially
like
if it's
a load balancer.
Yeah, it's just gonna, when F5 gets a request from you, it's checking to see the health of these servers, and that's kind of why you install those health monitors. So if it's on F5 or, you know, AWS, I'm sure has some load balancing, or Azure, I'm sure has some form.
Yeah.
They're all going to be fundamentally the same. It's going to be checking and having the status of each server. If obviously that server's still in the pool and offline, there's a chance it could serve, you know, that to you. But based on your configurations, typically it would just send you to a good server. And that way you would never notice anything. And that's kind of the goal there.
Yeah, and that is the goal, especially with cloud computing too. Uh-huh. The redundancy is, yeah, we have load balancers. Something happens on one server, it's going to jump us to another, and we wouldn't even know it as an end user. Another, yeah, good thing about load balancing is Nate can't pull a denial of service attack anymore.
Exactly.
I can't flood, sink flood. You know, I can't do any of that stuff. So that's just off the table. So that's a good thing too.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, good job on that. Good job on that. Hey, make this available in the chat, could you please? Or could you put it together and throw me an email? I might make this a project in the near future.
Would you like my PowerPoint and the training materials that I used?
That'll work.
Sounds great. I'll send that to you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I guess before we take off, I'd like to thank everybody for their presentations. Absolutely marvelous job, everyone. One thing that I do want to, Von Erich, I have three OSs that I can give you. I got one that's called Who Next, and exactly what I said, Who Next. I have another one that's called Tails. Okay. And then I have a Remux, which is kind of like a Linux emulator. Okay. Who Next is very light. Okay. It's a very light security OS. All right. So you can virtualize that pretty good. It's only like 2 gigabytes big. Tails is a operating system that operates on top of your existing operating system. Man, you don't have to virtualize this. Put it on a USB and throw it onto your computer. Wherever you go, public place, put it in. Guess what? When you remove that USB, everything goes with it. There's no temporary storage files. Forensics can't do anything because nothing's there on that host machine. True story. But I'll have that out. Yeah, I'll send it out to you. Okay. Or I'll put it in the chat later on. Okay, so just kind of keep an eye on that. David, for you, forensics. Okay. Now, when we're talking the evidence, most cases you're not allowed to examine the original in most cases. Okay. And when you can't examine the original, what tools would you be able to use? And there's a lot of good tools out there, and I'm sure, David, you got a bunch for us. Think of autopsy or F-disk. These applications can pull an entire computer system, okay, and all the information on it with almost 100% integrity, meaning you could possibly show this in court as evidence. Really, you're going to show the original in court, but you're going to analyze this so you don't F up the original. All right, guys, great job tonight. Any questions, concerns, or issues before we call the meeting? All right. Good night. God bless, guys. Have a good night, guys.
Good night. Thank you. Everyone did a very good job.
Is that Charlene?
Hey, Nate. Long time. I thought I heard your voice earlier, and I was like, is that Nate? I haven't heard you in a long time.
Oh, my goodness. We have to get together sometime this week or so, or next week.
I know. Well, I'm doing the same thing every day. I mean, I'm home doing my, you know, work and stuff. But I'm not working per se because my contract ended. So I'm basically just, you know, doing schoolwork.
Going back to school for the master's?
Yeah, I'm just finishing up the internship. I already did the courses because the last time I ended the my schooling was because my husband died.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so he passed, and so I couldn't deal with school plus taking care of all the stuff I need to take care of. So I stopped for 5 months in between there.
I see, and now you're back.
Yeah, I'm just trying to finish up so I can at least say I finished, you know.
Are you going to hang around afterwards?
After what, in this chat? Or in this?
No. Hang around Gita.
Oh, yeah. I would like to. Because I really missed it. I don't know.
You see a lot of new faces now.
Oh, I know. And I like how things are going, like in Planner, how you guys all changed it, which is better, a lot better than it was. Oh, yeah.
And you see we got a lot of stuff going on, too.
I know. I can't wait to, you know, really dig into things, but
certified if you can, because we got a lot of certification information out there. And
yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good to see you.
Yeah,
well,
nice
good
to
hear
you
from you too.
Yeah. And you will.
You're in cyber, right? Still?
Yes, I'm in cyber, and I'm trying to think of a topic to present in masterclass. So it's like, I don't know. There's so many topics.
I'd grab a tool that you're super familiar with, and demonstrate it.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah, everybody thinks cyber is like magic anyway. So if you just pick a tool that no one's really kind of seen or heard before, you ever heard of It's called W3AF.
Yeah, I heard of it.
You know how to use it?
No, not really.
It's kind of like a it's command line based, but it does the testing quick. Now it doesn't look good. But you know, with being in cyber, you can explain what's going on with that, you know, with the terminal commands. So it's going to test your system for vulnerabilities. Now, you know, you got Nessus and all these other, you know, ones that will report, like, you know, give you some readable report that you can give to the executive level, like Qualys or Qualys or something like that, right? Nessus. Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, those aside, okay, because, you know, the setup on that and, you know, trying to get the reports to look right and all that, which, you know, that the reports are automatically generated. So that's not a big thing. But this W3AF, it's so quick to use. Like you could probably do the presentation in 15, 20 minutes.
Oh, really?
How quick it is. Yeah. You'll do more explaining than actually configuring the application. Yeah. Take a gander at it.
Okay.
Yeah. But even if that's not the one, I would think that maybe demonstrating a security tool would be nice.
Security tool. Yeah, I should know some, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this last one that we did was financial based, you know, financial designs or whatever it's called. I forgot. But anyway, that one was kind of started off really good because it was based on math. And I like that. But the only thing is, we never had any demonstrations on how actually it works, or, you know, how you make a decision on your financial decisions based on that.
So are you going to be using like a project management tool like Power BI or Tableau to gather that information into a a viewer friendly?
Yeah, I don't know, because, you know, I could see how the tool could work, but then I didn't have any other tools to go with it. You know, they didn't really explain how you can use that in anything.
So, you know, like,
it's sort of like cut short, huh?
I see. I like a real life case scenario. It was,
yeah. They didn't have any real life case scenarios, but we had to explain some. So we, you know, searched for, you know, other websites where they use a case scenario, but not, I don't know, it was lacking because we never discussed it in our seminars. We never really actually put it into practice. I mean, it would have been nicer if we had something to actually see how it works, because we don't know how. I don't know how it works. I mean, I know how to plug in the numbers if you give it to me, but I don't know where you get those numbers.
I, you know, see.
Yeah, I don't know. I have to decide what I want to use, because that one, I don't feel that competent about it, only because I don't know how it works. But is there any website I can go to that would help me with that part of it?
Now, see, one thing you could do is go to the source. Okay. Whoever is the creator of this. You go to the source.
Okay.
Yep. And that's your best bet, is going best to the source to see how it's done. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I'll go do some research, but no guarantees, but I don't know. We'll see what happens.
When's your master class?
Not until March.
Shoot, you got time.
I got plenty of time, but, you know, I'd like to, you know, get, you know, work on it now rather than later.
Oh, I got you there. Proactive and reactive.
Mm-hmm.
I would say.
Yeah, but then, you know, when I first came in to this the internship now, I couldn't do any of my uploading files to the, you know, the intern weekly status report thing.
Did they change?
That form, they changed. So it's not at all like the old way we were doing it.
Right, right. We added to that status report because we wanted to take away in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
What we were thinking is you guys have to report too much. Okay.
Oh,
You know, you already got your assignments that you got to do on the academic side. Okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe filling out a journal on a weekly basis. You have to upload a status report. And then on top of that, you have to do, what was that other thing that we had?
You know, those boxes where we had to put what our tax was and, you know, when we started, when we ended it, you know, it was like
screenshots of your time. That
screenshots of the time. Yeah.
And see, so we put all of that information into the status report so we could just take some of the time off of you guys to do stuff.
Oh, I saw that. I did see that. But then when you guys redid that, for some reason, myself and this other fellow, we came back. So they gave us our same email.
That's Marcia.
And then that one wasn't working with the uploads because we tried to do that detailed time report and it wouldn't upload. And I was like, so what I did was just so I didn't lose my information, I put it in the old form anyway and got rid of some, you know, got rid of the boxes and whatnot. And so just so I can write down, you know, answer the questions on the form. The new form. So I had it on the old form because I changed the form to the new form, you know, with the same questions and stuff like that.
I see.
Yeah. So that's what I did. Only because, you know, I didn't know what to do. And I was like, I hate not being able to turn it in. But so I didn't turn it in. But I told my, you know,
your
supervisor whatever. Whoever you want to call them, professor or Dr. Jerry. Yeah, it's kind of funny. But anyway,
that's who you have is Jerry?
Yeah, Dr. Jerry. She's really nice.
She is nice. And I believe she's going to be helping us out at the internship too. We're hoping teaching staff in every department.
Oh, good.
And then, you know, on top of professionals, too, you know, and those that want to come back and help, too. But, you know, that teaching staff will be kind of like the bridge between internal Purdue, you know, what you guys do on the academic side and what we do on the PGIPT side.
Yeah, okay? That's very
kind of get side. Those guys together because, you know, years before, we didn't know what you guys were doing.
Right,
you know, and it's like we were making you guys do big projects when your class was making you do big projects too. So why don't we just do big project or two big projects and have it count for both areas? So we did a lot of that too.
Oh, good. Yeah, so that makes it better that way. So then you know the interns don't feel so undulated.
Yeah.
Because
I
know we had some of those that happened earlier on when I was there. And,
Yeah. Well, good talking to you.
Nice talking to you, too. I'm not sure if you're still at your old phone number, but, you know, I thought about calling you a couple times, but I figured you were busy working.
Oh, yeah. Well, I work during the day, so.
I know. That's why I didn't call you.
But my old phone number, which I had forever and ever and ever, I don't have anymore.
Oh, okay. I'll get rid of it then. Yeah.
Yep. So I think I have my phone number should be listed on my email. Okay. So you should be able to get it from there, or I can get you right here in the message here. Well, I'll send it to you privately. I don't want everybody.
Don't put it in public. I was like, well, you could just.
Yeah, I'll just Teams it to you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I'm not sure if you have my new phone number either. Let me look. Let's see what I have.
Go ahead and give it to me. I got my.
Okay.
Okay.
My phone number is 515 area code 499-4999.
You say 99?
Yeah. So a lot of nines and 4-4-9-9-4-9-9-9. Oh, there you are. I'll answer. Hold on. Hello.
You got my number there.
Okay, got it.
Yep. Well, good deal. You call me anytime you need to call me, and we'll keep in touch. You're in the cyber department, right?
Yes, I am.
How's
this
Daniel
time I made this time I made sure I was in the cyber area. Well, remember last time? Daniel. Yeah, but the last time I was in the internship, I ended up being in IT support because I didn't know which way to go and I didn't know I had a choice. But then I realized I should be doing cyber stuff and I wasn't, which I felt that was kind of a bad thing I did. But I did. I was able to help the IT support and, you know, took on some management leadership. So I did gain confidence in that part of it. So it's not all bad, but then I wasn't able to do any of the cyber stuff too much.
You know, I was under you in the cybersecurity department.
I know. Yes, I do remember after Doc, you know, appointed me for cyber because they were she was wanting me to go with teach governance.
Oh, GRC.
Yeah, because then it was she felt that we were you know, cyber at that time was going the wrong direction. She didn't want us going.
What was his
you know,
name again? Bobby or something like that, but he was a mess. That Bobby guy.
Yeah,
he was
Bobby.
Military.
He was
had a
kinda,
baby. Yeah, he just didn't really care much.
Yeah, which is kind of unfortunate. And so I think that's why she got me in there instead. And then, you know, we sort
and
of like.
The big move came and here we are today. And you see what you sprouted in cybersecurity. When you go into that cybersecurity department, you just start to smile because so much energy in there. I mean, the cybersecurity department, since you took over, and then when you were gone, I took over.
Yeah, which is great.
And then
a lot of things happened
really,
after that. Yeah.
Really kicked it up. But when you took over, things started moving. You know, we were like, okay, we need to start bringing demonstrations in. We're going to start making it more fun. And we did. And a lot more people, that's all they wanted was cybersecurity because of you. So thank you for that.
Oh, yeah. You're welcome. Anytime.
or
we all work together, Nate. I mean, you know, we're a team. So
we are quantum teaming.
Yep, quantum definitely. Teaming. And kind of felt bad about Doc, though.
Yeah, that was a sad day.
Yeah, because the last time I got to talk to her was in May of 2022.
I talked to her maybe a month before that. And I had been calling her regularly, and we would just shoot the shit. I mean, one thing that about Doc is the way that she could put words together.
And she would
call you into the conversation, no matter what it was. But she had the ability to draw you in, and all it was, you kind of felt like it was just you and her. That no other distractions were around.
Right.
And she could make you see things that normally you wouldn't be thinking or even looking to look at, you know, to find. So that was a good thing.
She was really good. Yeah.
Very open.
Yes. And that's one thing I liked about her. You know, it didn't matter who you are, what you think you are, who you, you know, know and who you don't know, but it's down to you, you know, what can you do, basically. So
she told me that she, you know, she didn't have much time left and she was kind of, you know, getting weaker by the day.
And
she loved the internship and she wanted to, she wanted to know if I could, take it over, you know, like, be her at that time. I couldn't because I was doing the emergency management thing, which would take me all around the stuff. So, I don't know if you've ever met, and I don't think you did. When you get like the Ashley Harringtons, you know, the power automate messages.
Yes.
Ashley was under me.
Ah.
And she's really good talent. I'm telling you, super great talent.
Oh, great, great.
Her and Jeff came out of the same group.
Wonderful.
So, yeah, I gave her cyber and she took it up a notch again. So you should see a Wikipedia, a cyber wiki.
Oh, I did see that. I did see that because I got a link to it.
And then, you know, the automated messages that you see. And we cleaned up the back end stuff, you know, like old files, firewall rules, policies, that kind of thing.
Still, wonderful.
We probably need to clean up the GRC site. I took a look and we haven't touched that since 2021.
Ooh, yeah. That probably needs looking at.
Yep. So maybe we could maybe get some of the cyber guys, including yourself, to lead a team to do that. Or, you know, and this go through Sean and Daniel to see what they think about that. That's a good thing. And then we need a static and dynamic testing of this new website that they're building on our AWS environment.
Oh.
And guess what?
That's interesting.
Nobody knows how to static test. Sean does, and Daniel does too, but nobody else. And nobody else is even willing to take a swing at static testing.
Oh.
Now, everybody wants to do the dynamic testing.
How come? Herb
Suite. You know, web application tools such as Nessus and stuff like that.
Right.
The fun stuff, but nobody wants to do the static where your files in, you know, the web page itself before it launches. Hot spots in the code. You're running a linter on it, you know. Nobody wants to do it. Now, software should be running their own linters on their own software on their own language. When you're writing, you should be running that linter while writing it. So you don't have any hotspots in the code. Then when we check it with static testing, we can find out if there's anything that they missed and if there's any syntax errors in the code that could be exploited.
Oh, okay.
Then we put it on the server. And then it's time to turn it on and see if it works. And while we turn it on and see if it works, we're going to do a dynamic test, which means that's the old, you know, all the stuff that Red Team already does. We find vulnerabilities in the code, in the website itself, in the server itself, and the software installed on that server. Any ways to get into it and any ways to try to manipulate it. Now, we don't want to tear up the code or tear up the site, but we want to let them know that, hey, look, this is the problems with it, and this is what needs to be fixed. And most times, cyber is going to have to fix the cyber side stuff.
Right.
We don't know anything about no dang software languages when it comes to writing it. But so then we would throw it back into their lab if there was any changes to the code itself that we
The soft dev,
Yep.
That team. I wouldn't mind, you know, doing some static testing, but I don't know where to start. I mean, because I've never done that.
Do some research on it.
Okay, I will.
Static analysis is what it's called.
Static analysis. Oh, maybe this is going to be part of my master talk.
Ooh.
My master class. That would be good, right? Do some research about this.
Do some research then, about it. Now,
yeah, and then
I don't
see how
I
come
about
up
it.
With. Uh-huh.
I want you to be able to demonstrate it, too.
Demo. Right. No, I understand that. Demo.
Now, it doesn't have to be a live demo. It could be pre-recorded, and you can just narrate through it live.
Yeah, that's okay. what they did tonight. Uh-huh. Cool. Well, that gives me an idea. So I will do some research on static analysis testing.
Yep.
And then come see what I come up with on that. Yeah. But that's a great idea, Nate. Because I didn't know and nobody was doing static, you know, testing. As you were
no
saying.
One has attempted to do it. Now, is it needed? Yes. And to tell you the truth, we should be running a dynamic test on what we have already. You know, our press site, our, what is it, PGIP pods?
PGIP.
Well, it's pods. It's like a kind of like a radio, like a.
Oh, yeah, the pods.
Podcast. Yeah.
Podcast.
Yeah, actually, I think they're renaming all those. Or renaming all of our meetings so we can podcast them.
Oh.
Yeah. I think the IT department, IT support, they're doing that. It won't be cyber.
Oh, I see. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, but get with Sean and Daniel and see if it's okay if you borrow like two or three people to do some GRC work on the company. And ultimately, you'd be looking at like our policies in place. Okay. And of course, you know, I can take you for a drive in our Microsoft environment to look at those policies. And match policies we have in SharePoint. Okay. That should be under the governance tab. All of our policies, all of our frameworks, all of our procedures, SOPs, BCPs, ERPs, DRPs, all of that, if applicable, should be in that SharePoint folder or in and then I can give you, you know, I can take you for a ride with the AWS and the Microsoft so you can see those policies as well and see if those policies are matching up with what we got in our governance management tab in SharePoint. And if it doesn't, then that means what are we doing in our environments here where our policies should match what our systems have. Been configured for.
That's true. Okay.
Okay.
I'll take a look.
Alrighty, boss. You have a good night.
You're right.
Soon.
All right, Nate. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Good night.
You too.